A draw snatched from the jaws of victory for Norwich City. On such moments, seasons can turn. Let's hope from a Norwich City perspective it doesn't pan out that way. Welcome to this week's edition of the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast, brought to you in association with First Bus Norwich. I'm your host, Connor Southwell, joined by Paddy Davitt. We should hopefully be joined by Samuel Seaman as well in a little while to reflect on a chaotic, frenetic, so close but so far draw for Norwich City in Lancashire at Ewood Park. It finished 1-1 yesterday. And Paddy, I guess we've got to start right at the end, haven't we, from a Norwich City perspective. Let me read you the numbers because I've got it in front of me here. The clock read 95 minutes, 12 seconds when Borja Sainz took the decision to run at two Blackburn defenders, despite obviously Norwich leading the game, having a man advantage, but also Jacob Wright being on the outside. Norwich give the ball away. They win the ball back. 12 seconds later, Marcelino Nunez has another chance to keep the ball. Instead, he tries to force a forward pass. Within 34 seconds of that initial, of Marcelino Nunez's concession in midfield, Andy Vyman heads home. The clock read 95:58. The referee played for 34 more seconds after the restart before blowing up. That is how close Norwich City were to a crucial 3 points after Antti Siinaks gave them the lead on 90 minutes. And I think when you look at it through that lens and with that context, you can understand why Johannes Hoftorp was quite as frustrated as he was come the final whistle yesterday.
And also, because he was asked about it after the game, it comes off the back of two, three games ago, Derby, Cairo, 1-0 into stoppage time, Jack Stacey, ridiculous decision, high foot. Not quite as high as that Millwall player in the Crystal Palace game on Saturday, I hasten to add, but high enough that penalty, slotted, draw. So those two games have cost Norwich 4 points, and it's not hyperbole to state that. And you add the 4 points in this congested playoff race to their tally now, and they'd be level on points, I think, with the sixth place side. So, and with 11 games left now, that's ground that might not be recovered. And okay, you know, I think we're all of the opinion, or most people are, that probably, you know, Norwich in the playoffs probably would be too soon for this group at this stage. But don't almost handicap yourself in that regard yourself, and take yourself out of that by, as Johannes talked about yesterday, some crazy decision-making in the 2 or 3 minutes post Antti Siinaks's goal. You've highlighted two players. I'm sure Johannes would concur that both of those were the poorest of decisions at a crucial time against, it's worth reiterating, it was against 10 men, 10 players. You know, Blackburn having had a man sent off 85th minute, Emmanuel Dennis, for a second yellow card. So you're 1-0 up, you're a player up, and they don't game manage that to a victory, which would completely have transformed the mood around that performance, that result, but also the context of the playoff picture as well, which is, you know, teams are now picking up those wins back to back. And for Norwich to, through nobody else's fault other than their own, that's the sore part of this really dissection that, off the back of Derby, they've done it again. And as Johannes also said in his post-match, maybe that's where this group are at the minute. Maybe they are, if you want to label it, naive. Maybe they are too inexperienced as a collective. There are obviously inexperienced players within this group, but maybe as a group going through this for the first time in many respects for a lot of those players, it's showing in those clutch moments, you know, where a bit more experience. And you see that game out, a bit more experience, and you see the Derby game out. And consequently, you know, they are firmly in the playoff picture rather than it feels like they're just on the periphery and they're just hanging in there, really, rather than they look like a group who are good enough to be really sustaining this top six aspiration all the way to the wire. They don't look like at the moment, and that was graphically illustrated yesterday. But that frustration is that for a lot of that game and a lot of the Derby game, they were able to decode the challenges faced and to the point where they'd engineered themselves into winning positions. But to not able to then see the deal off, I think it probably just reaffirms, as Johannes said, that this group aren't ready in the here and now to mix it with, you look at those other teams, Coventry now, what they're doing. Blackburn, dare one say it, they have a lot of experienced players. West Brom, and maybe one or two others will come out of the pack. Middlesbrough had a big win on Saturday, so we'll discount them. And I think the reality is Norwich don't have all the elements required. And it's not just about ability, and it's not just about quality. You know, there's other intangibles that you need to put together in where they find themselves now, which is a bit of a race for one, maybe two places left in that top six mix. I think it's sadly the case that they're probably just going to come up short, and the reasons why were graphically illustrated at Ewood Park, I think.
Yeah, and in terms of the situation more generally, it's now, 26 points they've dropped from winning positions across the course of the season. Of course, there is a net to this. They have also picked up, I think, 14 for or 12 to 14 in winning positions. So you add that up roughly, and we're talking more than 10 points at the very least that they could have on the board if some of that was there. You mentioned Derby. You could even go back to the reverse game in this fixture with Blackburn at home, where they scored very late. There are other cases as well throughout the campaign. Cardiff, I know that one's been lumped in. Is that just a byproduct, you think, of a very young, unripe group of players, and I guess probably the overall balance of it? Shane Duffy is basically the only sort of real experience in terms of games and championship games that they have in that squad at this moment in time. So is that a byproduct? Is it something that this group can learn from and develop? Is it something that is a little bit more ingrained? Because it does feel like it's been a trait of Norwich City sides over the last 2-3 years in the championship.
Difficult to answer, because you're obviously pulling in their different head coaches, different groups of players, different approaches. As you were talking there, Connor, my mind goes back to, you know, the benchmark really in terms of championship football in Norwich City in the last, I don't know, 7-8 years was the two title winning seasons under Farker and Webber's guidance. And I'm sure people could throw examples back where that those groups were similarly in certain occasions. But over the piece, I think if they were put into those scenarios against Derby and against Blackburn yesterday, they see those games out. And for me, it comes down just to experience. And we've talked about it. Ben Napper was asked about it midweek in that round of interviews. Johannes has been asked about it. Have they tilted too far in terms of this lowering the age profile towards inexperienced players? And if you get it too many of those, is that the byproduct, you know, what you were faced with yesterday? I mean, Sainz and Nunes, if you want to put the focus firmly on them, they're not necessarily inexperienced. I mean, they've been in the championship now 2 or 3 seasons in Nunes's case, and Sainz maybe 2 seasons now, coming up 2 seasons. So they should know what it's all about. But so I don't think it's simply an age thing or an inexperienced thing. It's a mentality thing as well, isn't it? And maybe for the last few seasons, but obviously this season, it's been about transitional rebuilding. Maybe internally the messaging isn't that we're quite targeting top six and promotion. And if that is the case, maybe on a subliminal level, it sort of feeds into not being ruthless enough, not having that killer edge, not putting teams to the sword. And that is something that this group of players need to learn. And as Johannes said yesterday after the game, you know, that is all a given, but it needs to happen at some point. And he is now, I think, enough is enough. I think it's got to the point now he wants it, this iteration from this group of players, that you can't keep putting yourself in winning positions and then letting, as you said, maybe a net 10 or 12 points slip through your fingers, because in a tight championship race, whether it's top two, top six, even bottom three, if you were in that scenario, then 10 to 12 points is a huge spread and can transform one way or the other. So, yeah, I mean, it's probably no definitive answer really with that, but all of those elements are in play, clearly. You know, there is a lot of inexperienced players in this group, but also maybe there is that mentality that if they're going to be serious contenders for promotion next season onwards, you can't let teams off the hook, because that's what the Leeds and the Sheffield Uniteds wouldn't do. Maybe Burnley as well. You see their defensive record. It's almost a bullying mentality. When you've got somebody where you want them, you stick on them, you keep them on the ropes and you keep pummeling away. You know, you don't let a team down to 10 players And it was such a poor goal to concede as well. You know, they've not. It's not as if it's some brilliantly constructed move that Norwich have to hold their hands up and collectively say too good. I mean, it was just simply a ball carved into the box, and Jakob Sorensen has allowed Wyman to run inside him and head it past Gunn. It's in execution and creation. It's such an avoidable goal, really. And yeah, for me, it comes down to mentality fundamentally, and they need to develop that. And maybe that only comes with coming through experiences like Derby, like Blackburn, a few of those other games you mentioned as well, and coming out the other side. And it's kind of that muscle memory. When you keep putting yourselves in those situations, the next time around, you would hope, as a collective, they would know what to do. They should know what to do anyway. But, you know, you would think if they find themselves between now and the end of the season in a scenario where they're leading going into stoppage time, that they could draw on some of these experiences, as bitter as they've been, to fall the right side of it. And if they don't, then for me, it's pretty clear. Then players have to be shifted out and on, and other ones have to come in. Because if they're not learning, at some point, you know, we know what the stated aim from this head coach, this sporting director, this now ownership model is: Premier League football. You're not going to get that delivered if you can't, in the situation they find themselves in against Blackburn, seal the deal. That's the top and bottom of it.
Yeah, and if we are saying that they're, you know, if all of these points for winning positions hadn't have happened, and we're talking about maybe, you know, with the net 14 more points, that would put them on what, 62? They'd be fifth. They'd be behind Sunderland. Obviously, you have to weigh that. It's a little bit lopsided because you'd have to weigh that out for the other teams as well. But it is, the point is that Norwich have still lost more points from winning positions than anyone else in the Championship, and that is, as you say, Paddy, something that they have to get a grip with and quickly. And Sam, I guess, there is obviously the frustration whenever you score in the 90th minute and don't go on to win the game. There's always going to be that frustration there. But also the frustration is that for so much of this game, for so much of what Norwich did and how they played, you know, and Paddy mentioned, I don't think they created enough chances probably for the territory in possession that they had, albeit, you know, Anis Ben Slimani should have scored. They had some other good opportunities where maybe the final action let them down. As a performance, there was so much to be encouraged by, and that is probably what gripes Johannes Hoftorp the most. It comes back to what we've discussed so much on this podcast this season. It takes Norwich City so much to score a goal and get themselves ahead. For their opposition, it doesn't seem to be as hard.
Afternoon, gents. Yeah, I mean, as you say, Torup was clearly quite pleased with the performance, and I think you're right that there were definitely some positive signs, especially second half. I thought they came out from the break and dominated the game in a way that they haven't really done this season. They sort of penned Blackburn back, which hasn't really been the case. It's more been, even when they've, you know, created chances and looked like an attacking force, that's come from almost moves that look like counter-attacking rather than having that, you know, that territory, that dominance. And they did have a bit of that in the second half. I'm not sure I thought it was quite as good a performance as maybe Torup did post-match. I thought there were times where the movement in the final third wasn't particularly good. Obviously, the quality sometimes, you mentioned that Slimane chance, and they had a couple of other situations where they probably should have created more. And I didn't think they really got in behind or tested the Blackburn defence as much as they did in that Stoke game, or maybe as much as they will need to if they want to be sort of promotion quality going forward. But for an away performance against a team who are sixth in the Championship, had that sort of cliched new manager bounce with Valerian Ismail coming in, are probably in with one of their best chances of getting back up to the Premier League since they were relegated. Yeah, it's the sort of performance that certainly you'd take as a Norwich fan. And that was the sense I got really from speaking to people outside the away end post-match, was that it was a sort of game that people felt was good enough to gain all 3 points away from home. So that probably does lead to the frustration. Obviously, we'll come on to all of the elements, but there were things like, you know, the Ante Siennats goal and the moment that would have provided for him, the clean sheet, you know, and the improvement that we've seen defensively, and the fact that that would have marked another strong performance at the back. So there were a few factors that it felt like Norwich would have been taking away really positively from Ewood Park, that now nobody will talk about because of that late goal. So, yeah, I agree that there are some frustrating elements. I'm not sure the performance was quite as good as Torup thought it was. And, obviously, he's got much more experience in analysing football games than me, so he may well be right. But I still thought it was a team that looked very inconsistent and for large parts of the game just weren't really that creative. And we can say, you know, they didn't create the chances, and that was the main thing that didn't go right. But this is supposed to be an attacking team. That's supposed to be almost the main function of what Torup's trying to do with the team at times. So although I thought there were good elements, especially away from home, I'm not sure it was really the perfect performance. But yeah, they did probably do enough to warrant those 3 points. And that does add to the frustration coming away from it.
Yeah, that was the big point for me, I think, for all of the possession and territory that they had, which clearly, as you say, is a massive improvement from what we've seen maybe on the road earlier in the season. There was that real lack of creativity. And you know, there were some times where they worked some really good opportunities, and there were lots of touches in the final third. And it was just that final decision and maybe a reluctance to shoot at some time. And sometimes, you know, just making the wrong decision, which clearly was a factor in obviously the equalising goal as well. And Paddy, I mean, if we take the... You know, obviously, there's clearly a lot of emotion and frustration around the way that Norwich City let 2 points slip, and that's understandable. But if you look at the curve of the last three away performances, the win at Watford, probably the second half at Hull, we're probably talking about, I think, for the bulk of this game, even though, as me and Sam have just said, they probably didn't create enough, there is sort of an improvement in terms of what we're seeing from Norwich City on the road. We are seeing them now go to ground and look a lot more like Johannes Hoftorp wants them to do, and actually how they look in terms of on the ball at least and controlling possession as to how they look at Carrow Road. It's just that final bit, isn't it? Connecting that sort of ruthless edge and that attacking streak that we see at home now to those away performances.
Yeah, and that in itself is frustrating because, as you say, a lot of the elements that have engineered some pretty emphatic home wins and certainly lots of goals in those home wins, they have started to exhibit away from home. I mean, it was that whole game where after the game, I mean, and that was off the back of those two disappointing Carrow Road games against Derby and Preston, where they hadn't won for three. And he made a point of saying, look, I'm sitting here as a coach who hasn't won for three games in the Championship, and it seems daft to say, but I'm very happy with those performance metrics or elements. And that's continued in these last games. Yet it's still weighed down by the frustrations that, you know, I guess come with a squad and a head coach who are still getting to know you in many respects. You know, this is still very much early days. Not even getting into all the endless and another turn of the wheel yesterday, injury sort of fitness related mitigation, which has stunted maybe that development curve, which I think Johannes, by his own measure, would have expected by this stage now, however many months into the job, 8-9 months into the job, without those injuries and sort of key players missing for large swathes, he would have expected them to maybe have that mirror image of what they produced more often than not at Carrow, both in terms of performance, in terms of style, in terms of control, and crucially, the real cutting edge in the final third. And we saw that most recently, Stoke City, the weekend before last, for this one. That hasn't really come to pass away from home. And that is obviously going to be tougher because it is different going away from home and having to deal with those elements. But yeah, I think that probably, again, is flows into this sense that they're not ready yet to be justifiably in that top six. And maybe even prolonging this flirtation with the top six, you know, that might fall away if they don't start to pick up some wins pretty short order, I think, because there'll be just too much ground to make up as we go down the stretch. So, yeah, it's just yet another facet of, you know, you can see if he gets it right, where this could go to and how Norwich could accelerate as a club and as a squad and what that then in terms of Championship status would do. And certainly would push them up into those upper echelons of, yeah, this is a group of players now under a head coach who can be talked about in terms of serious promotion contenders. At the minute, that isn't the case, clearly. And and what we saw yesterday in terms of the game management, but also zooming out a touch, while it has been better in these last two or three away games over the entirety of the season, they've looked short of, if your benchmark is a Leeds, a Sheffield United, a Burnley, when those teams go away, Sheffield United go to QPR yesterday. We saw what Norwich did when they went to Loftus Road, and it wasn't pretty. They go there, they get the job done. I don't know anything other than the result, but I guarantee they probably haven't played particularly that well coming off the back of losing at home to Leeds midweek. But they find a way, they grind it out, and that's what the teams at the top who really are targeting the Premier League do. Do we think this group of players right now under Torrop can go anywhere and grind something out? No.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. Not consistently, at least. I think we've seen it in isolated cases. Luton, although, you know, we could have a debate about how good Luton are and how much Norwich had to really grind out that win there. Albeit, you know, it's not to say it's an easy game by any stretch of the imagination, but you would like to hope that if that game was played now, Norwich could maybe be a little bit more emphatic. Watford as well, although, you know, we had a lot of issues with the second half and how they dealt with that. So we're not talking about sort of perfect streetwise performances, and it's probably that lack of nous, I guess, of experience, like you're saying. That doesn't have to be age. I think when we use the word experience, we collate that with age all the time. That's not necessarily the case. It's just maybe with experience. And that has to be the hope, I think, from this game, is that they can use it as an experience and it's something to learn from. That's all you can hope, albeit, you know, we said that about Derby and we said that about Cardiff and we said that about Blackburn earlier on in the season as well. So it's not the first time we've been at this junction. Plenty more to delve into, so let's delve into it, Sam. Unfortunately, you know, I think over the last few years we've done a pretty good job at being a podcast that doesn't really talk about referees or decisions or anything like that. It feels like this season we've probably dedicated more time to it than certainly I would like, and certainly probably you boys would like, because we want to talk about the football, we want to talk about Norwich. But we've got to talk about, obviously, the incidents that occurred yesterday, and I think we're talking probably about three or four. So let's start with Don Higham on Angus Gunn. I mean, it's a red card, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I have no idea how you can give the was it given as a foul in the end? Because there was a bit of a debate as to whether it was given as a drop ball or a foul. But I mean, if they saw it, then they gave a foul. If they didn't see it, then what are they doing? Because the linesman is right there. And if you see that situation, I just don't understand how you can possibly not give a red card for that. When we see the sorts of bans that have been handed out this season, particularly Kenny McLean, and I think that's an example that probably has already been compared to this one hundreds of times among Norwich fans over the last 24 hours or so. But you look at that McLean one, which earned him a 4-game ban, was stated in the FA reasoning as basically an unequivocal, definite red card. And then you see that elbow from Higham, which is what it is. It's a full elbow to the cheek of Gunn. And it looked actually really, really painful. His fist is clenched as he does it.
There's a movement as well, isn't there? I mean, we can debate the intent of it. I think he's actually probably just tried to block him, but his arm has gone up and there is a sort of movement to make contact with his face.
Has gone to block him, then he needs to be a bit more careful with it, because he's ended up elbowing someone on the jaw. You know, I can't understand personally how it's not ended up being a red card. And yeah, like you say, we try to stay as measured as possible, but there's only a certain point to which you can really do that, because it's an awful decision, and it feels like they're coming every week. Probably I feel like I see four or five decisions every single weekend in the Championship that are just seem blatantly wrong, and I'm not sure how you could really watch it back and decide that it isn't a red card, to be honest. So it's quite hard, as much as we like to provide balance and look at it maybe with a more analytical view, I don't think you can really do that with this one. And so all I can say really on it is I thought it was a red card as soon as I saw the first replay, and I think the more you watch it, the more that's what it feels like.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I know obviously there's been a lot of talk about retrospective ban. Obviously, Norwich are well-versed now in this area, and so are we. I think we're a lot more clued up now. But it's an interesting one because I'm not sure if the referee has given a free kick, because there was also, after that event, he called Higham over. There was a conversation. If he has, in that moment, given a free kick, I think that's pretty much deemed to be him seeing the incident. And so I'm not sure the FA could then intervene and offer a retrospective ban. I guess it'll all come down to whether it's included in a match report that the referee has to file and go on from there. But I'm with you. If there isn't any retrospective action and he has seen that in real time, it is a shocker not to have given a red card for. Paddy, I'll bowl two in your direction. There's the first one that of Dennis Onkrozene. Obviously got a red card eventually, but that first tackle, I think so I've seen Darren Huckabee and others say that should have been a straight red, and I guess we could probably lump that in with a decision against Norwich where Jacob Wright brought down the Blackburn winger. I think Ishmael said it was on the line. I've sort of watched it back. I think it's outside where the contact starts, but I'll bowl those two at you. What's your view on those two incidents?
Well, the first, yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Hux's if that's what he said on social, but it was wild because he's out of control and the force that he's hitting with as well. And he stayed down for a prolonged period and it wasn't a play acting stay down either. You could see he was in a lot of pain. So in the modern game, if that had been a red, I don't think he could have had any complaints really, because it wasn't controlled. I don't think he got anywhere near the ball either, did he? Which is, you know, quite a key element when you're going to try and win a tackle is you actually make contact with the ball. So, I mean, Ishmael, I don't know whether he was just trying to colour the water a little bit post-match, but he seemed to think Krasny made the most of when that was only a yellow, the second challenge, same two players in the box. Krasny just got there quicker to clear across. And I think he's making a genuine attempt to win the ball on that one, but I think he still has caught him and it's quite high. Not quite Stacey-esque against Derby, but still high enough. And so that is, that is a second booking. So, but yeah, Ishmael seemed to think he made the most of it, but I don't, that's what goes on.
Yeah, he didn't see the elbow though, did he?
If it was an elbow, yeah, no, he didn't see that incident at all, which again just underlines, selective vision.
He's got a career as a Championship referee in him then, maybe,
yeah. So no complaints. I don't see how you could have any complaints if you're Dennis. Pretty stupid, really, to make that second challenge after the first one, really. But and then the second, I was of the same opinion that it was outside the box. I mean, there is this again, and I don't know quite the guidance as it stands, but if the challenge is outside and then it continues on and the player falls inside the box, I don't know whether that colours the waters or whatever. That seemed to be what Ishmael was inferring. It was on the line, and he obviously his momentum carried him into the box. So I would have to go and check what the actual wording is or the guidance to officials in that regard. But there's no doubt the initial contact was outside the box. And as much as Norwich fans might want to berate Mr. Doughty for what he didn't see with Higham and Gunn, he did see that and he made a very important call, because it would have been easy. That was at the Blackburn end, in the context of that game, to point to the spot. But, he stuck with what he saw in that incident. So, yeah, on both of those calls, I didn't think there was any. Of course, if you're Blackburn, you're gonna see it a different way, aren't you? But any impartial observer, I don't think would contest those two decisions were the right ones.
No, agree with that. And then Sam, I guess the final one is the goal. There's been a lot of chatter about it being offside. It's tight. I haven't seen a particularly great sort of still image of it. All of them are quite grainy. I think personally it probably falls within the margin of human error that without automated offsides or, a painful 5-minute VAR process, it's probably close enough that I think it's fine. I mean, we see what the alternative is in the Premier League, and it's almost robbing those 96th-minute equalisers, which even though it was against Norwich, I don't think anyone really wants to see that for how close that decision was.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I think when it's at the point that we've all seen replays and you can pause it on a screen and you're still not quite 100% sure, then I don't think you can really have much of a grievance with the assistant referee, because you have to also remember it depends when the frame is being paused. You know, it's so close to that one that I don't think, compared to some of the rest of the decisions that were made, you can't really be too upset at that one. And yeah, as you say, if we don't want VAR in the Championship, which obviously everyone has their different view on, but that's the sort of one where, yeah, maybe an intervention would have been quite frustrating. And, you know, I'd probably take it back to that Taimer Pukki goal against Tottenham all those years ago. And I still don't think any of us know 100% whether he was onside or not. That it was similarly close today. And given how robbed Norwich fans still feel to this day by that decision, it's basically, you know, the shoes on the other foot with Blackburn and how they would have felt if that one had gone against them. So, yeah, I mean, it's possible. There's obviously a percentage chance that it was the wrong decision. But when you compare it to some of the blatant errors that I think we've seen this season, that one is much easier to forgive for me.
Yeah, I'd also focus on, you know, as me and Paddy spoke about at the top of the show, the errors that Norwich made that led to that moment even happening, rather than whether or not that was on or offside. And again, reoccurring topics, we seem to talk about injuries every week, Paddy, and we're talking about another one today. Lewis Dobbin looked a bad one, didn't it? Really opened up his legs for the first time in the game, and it's that horrible sort of pull up that you see players do that instantly feels like a bad one. And I guess, again, we're having to ask questions of Norwich's process, aren't we? Because this is somebody who got taken off a week ago against Stoke with a slight calf issue. There was obviously a week between games. Norwich assessed him. He was viewed to be fit enough to not just feature at Blackburn, but to start. Started pretty brightly. It was his cutback for Anis Ben Slimani. As I say, the first time he really opened up his leg, he pulls up and it looks like he's aggravated his injury. And I guess we've been here before with Norwich City injuries. I guess Liam Gibbs is the headline one, but even Marcelino Nunez, I know it was a different hamstring, but to have sort of two hamstring issues. We obviously had Mateo Jurasek with a thigh issue. Anis Ben Slimani's had countless issues as well. The fact it's the aggravation of the same injury, it's got to throw a few question marks, hasn't it, for Norwich?
Well, what it will do is it doesn't dissuade those who've maybe made their mind up that is a justifiable criticism to level, because the same player with the same injury a week on is clearly deemed fit enough to start that game. That's the communication between Johannes, his coaching staff, the medical sports science physio teams. So there's either something's gone wrong in the process or it's just a terrible bad luck. But how many case studies fall into terrible bad luck over the course of a season for you to feel it is terrible bad luck or that there is something more? I mean, I can only go back to, you know, that sit down with Ben Napper last week, the Radio Norfolk chaps. They bowled readers or listeners, sorry, questions at the sporting director, one of which was about this topic. That would tell me that there was more than one supporter had got in touch with them to ask about it. So that narrative is out there. Ben's answer ran along the lines of, yep, didn't name specific players, but there was one or two cases that possibly that is fair criticism of their processes and practices and methodologies. He talked about every injury they have, they reverse engineer it back just to see if there's anything that could have done differently. You know, how we know he operates now and how he reiterated in those round of interviews last week about looking for those marginal gains, the use of data, trying to be ahead of the curve. All of those elements you would think would also flow into how they treat and look at treating injuries and rehabbing players. So, you know, if we're still sort of talking about these issues on this scale in seasons to come, then you would have to say that maybe there is something deeper going on in terms of what their processes are. But in the here and now, yeah, it's not going to stop people talking about, is there an issue about how Norwich rehab players? Because, you know, in the space of 7 days, having taken the precautionary step to whip him out of the firing line at half-time against Stoke, so they erred on the side of caution. And Johannes, to be fair, has erred on the side of caution. Now Sargent came back and how he stepped up his match minutes, Nunez as well. There's been one or two other examples. So, you know, there is that managing risk element that we can see visibly, but it also needs to carry through in terms of those stages between injury diagnosis and there you go, Johannes. This player has now completed their rehab. They're fully fit to go and you can build them into your program again. So, you know, sadly, this Dobbin episode does nothing to dissuade clearly a growing number of Norwich fans that there are certain things in terms of the medical sports science recovery areas that could be improved and could be looked at.
And Sam, I mean, above all else, it's getting for the lad himself, because I think we've seen a player there that in the, month, 2 months or so that he's been at the club, really kick on and advance and really show what he was about. I mean, I'm quite happy to say he's sort of won me over. I think initially I kind of looked at him and thought, it's a young Premier League loanee who's got, you know, pace, but he's very, very raw and maybe hasn't got the maybe football development as of yet to connect his pace with goal scoring opportunities or to know yet how to really make use of it and to be a threat. But I think increasingly over the last few weeks and games, he has shown that he does have that. And, you know, he added obviously the brilliant goal that he scored against Stoke. There was the other one that he scored as well. And I think we were beginning to see him add a real nice balance to Norwich City's front four and just offer them something slightly different. And it's a shame. And obviously we're talking before we know how long he's going to be out for, but if it is one that is going to end his season, which I think is all of our fears at the moment, and Johannes sort of said he was pessimistic on it as well, it would be it may not be the end of his Norwich journey, but it'd be a really sad loss at this stage for him and where he's come from and the season that he's had more than anything else.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you have to go back to the West Brom spell that he had to really establish the context behind that, because it would have been really frustrating for him. You know, he's gone to Aston Villa in the summer, loaned out to West Brom. He's absolutely desperate to make an impression and try to get into that Villa team for next season. And, you know, he barely starts a game, doesn't get any goal contributions, comes to Norwich, makes a start that I think you described well in terms of the typical Premier League raw loanee. And I'm sure he wondered at points whether that was what his season was going to end up being, just a sort of bit part player who'd ended up being in the squads of two Championship clubs and never really made an impression. But I'm sure he's been absolutely delighted with the last few weeks, as many Norwich fans have been. And for some of them to be talking about him as a Borja Sainz, a potential replacement, tells you how highly they rate him just based on the last few performances. So at this point, when he seems to have actually got himself so high in the pecking order that he's there ahead of players who were bought for 8.5 million in the summer, who have played hundreds of Championship games, who have been at Norwich for several years. And then just as it gets to crunch time in the season, as he starts to establish his role in that team, getting that injury, yeah, I'm sure he's absolutely gutted. And as you say, if this is the end of his Norwich City journey, then it will be really, really disappointing, because he's only shown his best really for sort of five or six games. He also gives them something a little bit different up there. And I think that's something that Torup has spoken about at length in terms of his running in behind and the fact that when Sargent drops deep, he's the person who will fill that hole and will go in behind. And actually, I didn't think there was enough of that after he went off the pitch. So yeah, for Norwich and for him, it's quite a significant blow. And it's one of those where you hope either that this story does continue with him at Carrow Road in some form in the future, or that he's at least able to play for the club again, because you get the sense he was almost on his way to sort of cult hero status in the same way that many loan figures do. And given the number of unsuccessful loans that there have been at Norwich and the low percentage rate, to have hit one that seems to have worked perfectly and then for him to be injured, yeah, that is a bit of a blow for Norwich. And yeah, hopefully there is some sort of better ending to this, because I don't think his performances deserved things to end like that. And certainly given the context around it and the way that his career's gone over the last few months, it was absolutely terrible timing for him.
And he had the look of a player that was really enjoying himself and really starting to enjoy himself as well. Just very quick fire, because we're a little bit pressed for time. We've got quite a bit more to run through. But just quickly for both of you, if that is the end of Lewis Dobbin's season, Paddy, would you be, if you were Mr. Napper, picking up the phone and seeing if you could engineer a permanent return in the summer based off what you've seen?
Yes.
I'll come back to you. Sam, just on the same question, really.
I would, but it depends on the price.
So that is going to be my second point to it. Again, very, very quick fire. So I'm with you, I would. But again, I think probably all of the answers here is contingent on whatever the price point would be. So look, clearly he joined Aston Villa in the summer. I think it was for £9 million. There was obviously a lot of PSR stuff happening in that time. I think Tim Irabuganum, who I think I've butchered his pronunciation, but he went the other way, didn't he? He went to join Everton, and we saw it with Elliot Anderson and Minto, who went to Brighton. There were lots of these kind of transfers. Dobbin was one of those. So I would probably expect Villa to maybe expect to make a loss on him just because of the way that transfer is quite unique anyway. So again, very quickly and very quick fire, what's the highest that you would go for him, Pad, in terms of a fee? Where do you think he's at?
Well, I draw a parallel with the Urasic and Cernach deals. I think, in the same ballpark for me. I think they've shown they are willing to commit to that profile of similar type of pitch as well, attacking wide player. So, anything around £5 million, I think, would represent an excellent bit of business. And the reality is, Villa will want to trade him because their trajectory is such now. I mean, even, let's be honest, Buendia isn't going to be part of it moving forward, I don't think. And he's a much further down the path of a first-team option. So this guy isn't going to get anywhere near Villa's first team. They let Philogene go to Ipswich. He was clearly further up the pecking order, the food chain. So they will be looking to move him on this summer, and let's hope Norwich are in that race.
Yeah, absolutely. Sam, I don't know if you've got anything to add to that at all, but I basically concur with Paddy.
Yeah, I think similar. I'd be sort of going up to £6 million plus add-ons, but it's always quite hard, theoretically, because I'm saying that. And then if Villa turned around and said 6.5, would you turn around and say no? Probably not. So yeah, I think in a similar ballpark to the other players who they've signed in that area, but there are a lot of factors going, and you know, I'm trying to be quick fire, but you know, he's homegrown, he's young, lots of good factors. So yeah, I'd be similar ballpark, maybe around sort of £6 million.
Yep, I agree. Let's move on to another young player then before we look ahead to Oxford. Antti Siinats, I think it was his sixth goal of the season yesterday. I was a little bit surprised when I looked into the numbers last night. So he now has, and obviously there's lots of context to wrap around this, which I will do afterwards, but he now has more championship goals than Willy Nonto at Leeds, Kiefer Moore at Sheffield United, Mac Targay, who was playing for Blackburn. He's level with what Jordan Rhodes produced in 18-19. It's probably more impressive because I think over half of his minutes have come as a right winger rather than a striker, which Ben Napper said that he was. But equally, if you look at that sort of under 21 age bracket, he is now the joint top scorer with Mayenda at Sunderland in terms of six goals. So I guess, Paddy, the question around that is, and clearly, and we've discussed this at length, so much of the analysis of that man is fairly or unfairly, I think often unfairly, through the price tag and the price point that Norwich City paid for him. But do you think it's been a little bit, I don't want to use the word over the top, but do you think he's been quite impressive given his return and his age and whatnot? He's only just turned 21.
I think those numbers, I think it's 6 goals, 4 assists, isn't it? If I'm not mistaken. I think that will catch out the vast majority of their one say media and the fan base. I certainly wasn't pitching him at that level because of the perception that when he struggled, he's looked a pale imitation of Sargent when he had that prolonged emergency shift down the middle, even though Napper does see him as a direct replacement maybe in seasons to come. There's a lot of perception and misconception, I think, about his season for a parking the fee. Nothing to do with him. That's what Norwich agreed with his Polish club. But for a young player coming from a very, very different league in terms of tempo and physicality and intensity, and we know that because Johannes has spoken about that in terms of the journey he had to go on. And young man in terms of off the pitch as well, not probably here with his family, culturally very different, you know, living in England, I'm sure. All of those factors, I think you'd have to say that's a good return at this stage of the season. What I liked, yes, that was a wow finish. That was just like almost a cannon, how he connected with that ball and fizzed into the back of the net. That tells you the quality and the technique that the guy has. There's clearly elements of his game he has to work on, as there were, and it's a parallel that's been made often with Josh Sargent circa first season in England. You know, many of the same charges that were being levelled at him, you could probably level at Cernac. And look how he's developed with time, with an understanding of what the number nine is all about in English football, but particularly the Championship, with good experienced players to lean into as well. And hopefully he's getting a bit of that now with Sargent, who is in playing years is vastly more experienced. So I think if this season was to finish now, I think that is a very good platform for him to hopefully kick on and learn some of the elements that he has to learn in his game. Because there's no doubt, and that finish for me proved it, at Ewood Park, there is plenty to work with. The raw material is there. There is something to mould. Physically, he has that, and I'm sure he'll fill out and get stronger, more muscular, more robust. But he has that explosiveness as well, and clearly he knows where the goal is. His record in Poland in that one season when he really blossomed tells you that. But of course, coming into England and stepping up, they're the question marks. There's still plenty of question marks, but and I guess what won't help him moving forward is still the millstone of the price tag, because it was, for Norwich, certainly quite an aggressively priced deal. You know, you don't tend to associate Norwich going into those. I mean, that's Ricky van Wolfswinkel levels of expenditure. That's not really where Norwich normally go through successive eras of sporting director, chief exec, head coaches, managers, directors, owners. So that's why it was a bit of an eyebrow-raising deal, just purely because it's at a level for an unproven 20-21-year-old, as he was then, player that we probably haven't seen too often, if at all. I'm struggling now to think of an outlay they've committed on that scale for a player of such inexperience, certainly in terms of the English leagues. So that brings with it a weight of expectancy and pressure, but there's no doubt that in terms of if you can almost detach yourself a little bit from that element, his numbers, given the challenges he's had to face, are more than decent, and less the numbers, but more some of the quality of his play, some of the quality of those goals and finishes tells you that, in the right setting and the right environment, and you'd think Torrop is the right type of coach for him, that, you know, he could, and this is what they're clearly hoping when they commit to that figure, that he catches, he goes science acceleration in terms of suddenly explodes in terms of his numbers. And then, let's be honest, 8.5 for a player of his age and attacking profile would look ridiculously cheap. So that's the educated gamble they've taken. But I don't think there's any doubt now. And, you know, that goal yesterday typified it, that there is something there to work with. But clearly, you know, he needs to kick on. The people around him need to give him that environment and that responsibility. And hopefully we do see that acceleration, and it isn't, a kind of a plateauing in terms of, you know, his output. And if it is, then clearly it won't be deemed a successful transfer. But it feels like at the moment, you know, it could turn into the sort of deal that, you know, a bit like, you know, dare one say it. Well, I'm going to say it, but I don't mean in terms of what he could go for. But you know, you look at the hyperinflation that the Buendia sort of type of transfer brought in. Gabby Zara, that's probably a better example, actually, in terms of, certainly Zara was initially 6 million. You know, that was not an inconsiderable outlay, but one season of real productive Championship football, and he goes to Galatasaray for multiples of that, and will probably go on again if he continues on his trajectory. So that's where we could be with Cernac. But of course, that's the genesis of recruitment. Nobody can tell. Nobody has the benefit of hindsight when they do these deals for that amount of money, whether it comes off and it becomes a Gabby Zara, or, sorry, Ricky, it becomes a Ricky van Wolfswinkel.
Yeah, agreed. I do think there's been, I think that, and again, for what you explained there very eloquently, that I can understand why there's been a lot of criticism and expectation on him. But I do think it's been a little bit harsh at points when you just remember how young and inexperienced he was. And I mean, his return of 6 goals, I mean, for context, that's the best that Adam Eder got to in 3 Championship seasons. Again, with the context that he didn't play as many minutes as Cernac has this season in any of those. But even so, I think it's a pretty impressive return. I'd like to see him shoot more, to be honest. to put it really simply in terms of how I think he can take it to the next level, because those six goals have come from 13 shots on target. He's had 26 shots in total this season. I mean, it's just not that many in terms of, you know, compared to his 90s. I think he's basically played 23 and a half 90s if you split it all up. So he's averaging just over a shot per 90 minutes, which is pretty low, I think, for the position that he plays. But clearly, when he does shoot and he does have the quality that we saw yesterday, and there are other examples as well. The one at Stoke sticks out to me. I'm sure you boys can maybe think of other goals that he scored. There is that quality and that accuracy from range. Really nice technique about him. Physically, I think he's got a good profile. He's tireless. He presses hard. I think there's a lot going for Antti Siinats. And you know, he doesn't turn 22 until 2026, I think. So that's a very good place to be. And I know Ben Knapp has spoken about it a little bit, but from what you hear, he seems quite an introverted person as well, and clearly adapting to a new culture and environment in English football where you're having to speak a second language, if you're quite introverted anyway, can be perhaps a little bit more difficult. So you'd hope year two for him could be really, 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 really exciting. I don't think we're going to have time to really reflect on Ben Knapp. I know, Sam, you obviously spoke with it at Adam at length. If people want a little bit more reaction, then they can do so. But Paddy, I don't know if you've really got anything, just because you haven't sort of spoken about it publicly, at least, if there's anything you want to mention about Ben Knapp, or whether you think it's all been covered, or whether you think he spoke for 30 minutes and didn't really say anything. Is there anything that sort of stands out from the chats that he had?
Well, only the contrast in tone and sort of delivery with his predecessor. I think it typifies, you know, that Norwich have gone in a different direction, and that starts with the messaging and what they're trying to do. I think you're not going to get the fireworks from him. There's not going to be any sort of standout kind of headline grabbing sound bites, because I don't think that necessarily is his personality or his character. But if you actually sit and digest what he said, I think you do get insight into this kind of almost forensic overhaul that he's overseen and continues to, because it's still 12, 15 months in, you know, so much more. But how he's talked about alignment of the academy and the first team and some of the coaching kind of tie-ups as well, and the women's team as well as part of that. And, you know, I think if you'd have sat and listened to any of those interviews, yeah, okay, you could argue that you know, he's not come out and said Borja Sainz will be in a Norwich shirt next season, or we're going to sell Marcelino Nunes for 20 million or whatever. But, you know, anybody who's expecting that has clearly not listened to him, any of his public utterances since he walked through the door. He's a very different operator. He's much happier working behind the scenes and basically being judged on his work, I guess. And, you know, for me, if you know that, then you know what you're going to get from any sort of public-facing touchpoint from him. He's not going to suddenly tell you that they've reinvented the wheel. It's going to be reinforcing what we all know now, surely, that there is a strategy. It's very clearly signed up to by above him, Attanasio in Norfolk Holdings, and below him, Johannes and his coaching team, and below them, the players. And we know what the pillars of that strategy are, and they're just trying to get better and better at delivering that strategy, be it across recruitment, style of play, developing young players, the pathway to the academy. For me, it just reinforced that, you know, they're not going to be maybe blown off course by events and maybe some of the challenges they face in windows, recruitment windows, that they can navigate those and come through the other side and still stick to the strategy. And we saw that obviously most recently, closing days of the January window with, you know, going out and getting Jacob Wright and Rory McConville.
Yeah, agreed. Let's look ahead to Oxford then to end the show. I mean, it's not a completely parallel situation, because obviously Norwich won at Watford and it was a 2-point gap rather than a 4-point gap, Sam. But after obviously the disappointment of yesterday, there are now two home games coming up. Obviously Oxford on Friday night, Norwich playing back-to-back Friday nights, which is great. Then obviously Sheffield Wednesday at home. I mean, are we now at the point of the season where we're talking about Norwich City probably needing to extract, if not maximum points, then at the very least 4 points from these next two home games?
I think we probably are. It's the sort of game that probably they should expect to be winning as well, when you look at how they've done in games like that this season. And although it's been almost entirely inconsistent, if there's one thing you can bank on, aside from those Derby and Preston games, it's that they've been able to beat teams who are sort of below them in the league or in and around that mid-table area who you'd expect them to beat at home. I think it probably will serve them best to just forget about the playoffs for a bit, because I'm not sure with some of the inexperience that they've got, with some of the moments that they've had in big games, like, you know, obviously at the weekend, I'm not sure it really is helping them to have that pressure of thinking about how many points off the playoff places they're going to be if they win a game or what the permutations are. I think what they need to be doing for now is just focusing on producing the best performances they can, improving as a team, maybe looking more to that longer term project. And if they do end up in the top six, then that's a bonus. But for me, when you're in a position like they are and you've got some of the weaknesses that they have in that team, it's not really one that's best served by focusing very much on the short term and what their goals are. I think you look at last season and the group that David Wagner had, it was a very experienced group. It was a short-term driven group who maybe had, well, definitely had less left in their career to try to achieve these things. So for them, from a motivation point of view, from a desire to sort of stand up and be counted, I think it suited them to put the pressure on that short term and to be looking at the playoffs all the time and thinking about what's the permutation, you know, how does it affect their goal, you know, going into these games, and what will the results do to that points total. But for where they are now, obviously, you know, we're free to keep talking about the playoffs, and I'm sure we will until it's either confirmed or completely dead. But for them right now, although it is a big game, and as you say, it does feel like they need to be winning it, there should probably be as little of that behind the scenes as possible, because I feel like right now that playoff talk isn't really helping them.
I would concur. So I'm going to do more of it. just for this final point, Paddy, because I think you begin to look down the stretch a little bit with these games. Clearly Norwich, the next two at Carrow Road. After that, what could be potentially, if let's say Norwich take 6 points from those two games, Bristol City play 3 times before the teams meet at Ashton Gate on the 14th of March. They've got Millwall on Tuesday as their game in hand. They then play Hull next Saturday before playing Sheffield United on the Tuesday. Obviously, Norwich have Sheffield Wednesday at Carrow Road. It feels to me like if Norwich City want to, obviously it'll be 9 games left after the next two games with Bristol City to play as well. If they want to make that Bristol City game really, really interesting, the next two games are really important to ensure what we avoid is what we had post Watford with obviously the Derby and Preston episodes.
Oh, all day long. Yeah, it's got to be 6 if it is playoff equations we're talking about, because they've blown... Let's be honest, this takes us full circle to where we came in on this podcast. Yeah. They've blown 4 at Blackburn and Derby now. And obviously you could argue there's other games you could throw into the mix, but in the very here and recent now, it feels like they've backed themselves into a corner. If they really do harbour ambitions to go right to the wire, if they don't take 6 from these next two, then I think they're probably game's up.
And there's the challenge. That's where we will leave this week's podcast. Paddy, Sam, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you all very much for watching and listening. We will be back next week after that Friday night clash with Oxford. Of course, the beauty of it being a Friday night means Norwich City get to go first. They can apply some pressure to those teams around them who play later in the weekend. So let's hope that's what we're talking about rather than what this pod has been about, which is another missed opportunity in that top 6 race. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next time.